You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Nikita.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
You know, I would use very much the same language you just used. and with the same tone, even lower energy, I would say. But I'm prepared to rally for this occasion, a conversation with you. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. And you are Nikita Petrov, publisher of the Psychopolitica Newsletter. And also you contribute to the Non-Zero Project. And I got to say, of all the people on the Non-Zero team, of the many Russia experts we have on the team, you know, I pay all these retainers, you know, it's just, we have all these Russia experts, but you really are one of the leading ones. And that's why I've decided to talk to you today. You grew up in Russia. Your name is mm-hmm. Nikita.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to talk about the Ukraine situation. And you're going to give us hard-to-find insights into the situation in Russia, which is very relevant to the prospects of peace, for peace, actually, I think. What the situation is there, what kinds of perspective Putin has and pressures he faces and so on. Anyway, today, there's a meeting in Florida with the Ukrainian delegation and Witkoff, our, real estate mogul diplomat. And I guess he met with the Russians earlier in the week. I don't know. Do you have any sense for whether there's actual momentum here or they're just going through the motions or?
I've heard every take on that spectrum from there is literally nothing happening. It's just like we're going to go through these cycles of gesturing, which I can see that too. The latest thing I've heard position from like a Russian who lives in Germany and works with European politicians. He says this is the first real attempt at negotiation. This is the Trump administration starting to do this in earnest. Like, okay, here's a list, 28 points. Here's what we've gathered so far. Talk to the Russians, talk to the Ukrainians, try to figure out whether there is an actual agreement to be reached.
Mm-hmm.
My sense initially, the very first thing that got my attention was Zelensky's address after that 28-point plan leaked to the nation. And he sounded uncharacteristically urgent and grim. Like every once in a while, there's a moment where you have to talk to the nation and, you know, don't pretend things are going well. We have to talk frankly here. This is one of the hardest moments in our history. The fork mm-hmm. is either he called it the hard 28 points or the risk of losing a key partner. And just seeing that speech, it seemed like maybe the US is like letting him know, we gotta soon sign something and here's our proposal. And there is mm-hmm. like pressure.
And he wants to kind of convey a sense that he's doing this under American duress, maybe to right. insulate himself from whatever political fallout there is. I'm not really sure the nature of that fallout. But I've always thought that this is a role that an American president could actually play for him, is play the bad cop. I wrote things about that during the Biden administration. When, you know, Ukraine could have gotten a much better peace deal than they could get now. As for the pressure, I do want to look into like what pressure is faced on both sides. It seems to me that broadly speaking, just Ukraine is in a tougher spot in the sense that, they seem less equipped to endure the continued war for a very long period of time. But as for the price he pays for, you know, peace on terms that are less than ideal, it's a little unclear to me to what extent the problem is actually mass public opinion there, and to what extent, because you also hear about there's just this nationalist element in the military, and sometimes it sounds like, you know, they might kill him or something, but it's unclear to me to what extent it's some kind of elite power in the military, especially, and to what extent it's public opinion. He certainly seems to be trying to move public opinion in the way you said toward accepting that they're going to have to make some hard choices, and that it's not entirely his fault, that, you know, Trump's just a hard ass and he has no choice, right?
Yeah, I'm not. So I said this is the first thing that really got my attention, but it's been, I don't know, a couple of weeks since then now, or maybe a week and a half or something. And since then, Ukraine met with the US. They said we adjusted the plan. So now it's not 28, but 22 points. They met with Russia. So, like, it seemed, now it seems to me like what you're saying. He made this rhetorical stance like, I'm entering into very hard, tough negotiations. We're being pushed by the power. And I'm going to do my best to argue for what we can here. And then they met and like, okay, so we're not doing this. We're not losing this territory and that. And then maybe with Putin, there's not a ton of transparency. We don't really know what the conversation was like and whether they concluded something, but the gist of it is there is no deal, and Russia said there are some things we're not going to bulge on. And so that seems to me like almost the exact repetition of what happened after the Anchorage meeting.
Mm-hmm.
There is just like Trump talks to Putin. Putin says, here's what I think needs to happen, and I'm prepared to negotiate a peace with these key demands.
Mm-hmm.
Trump says, makes sense to me. We'll talk to Ukrainians. Ukrainians say, this doesn't work for us. We can agree on this, this, and this, but not the rest. Let's postpone until later. Let's do a ceasefire now and then discuss the rest. Americans go to Russians. Russians go, that doesn't make sense to us. We're winning in the war. And so you just like do this, talk to the one side, talk to the other side. Their positions are not, they fundamentally are opposed to one another, not acceptable to one another. And so the war continues because it's not against the immediate interests of the decision makers on either side to stop now.
Yeah, I want to ask you a little about the situation in Russia because, you know, again, ostensibly, on the surface, it looks like Ukraine is less equipped to survive war for a very long time. Until recently, it was said that, well, they had this big advantage in drones, but now the story is actually no. Russia is kind of caught up in drones. Certainly, Russia has the advantage in manpower. And, Russia also has the advantage of not particularly depending on possibly shaky allies for support. Now, they're getting some kinds of help in a sense from China. But, I mean, Ukraine and others who are helping them, if nothing else, evade sanctions and
there's also Iranian drones, and there was the North Korean involvement.
Yeah, some stuff. But, I mean, you know, first of all, both of those countries are under leadership that will probably be the same next year and the year after that as it is today. You never know for sure, but whereas the Western democracies in Europe, I think at a popular level, some of them already face real skepticism about how long they should keep giving money to Ukraine and giving weapons to Ukraine, and who knows what the next election will bring. So, you know, Ukraine's situation just seems much more shaky. They're running out. They're going to run out of men sooner. And the things you hear in reply to that, you know, for people who say, hold on, Russia may be weaker than we think. You tend to hear two things that maybe you have some insight into, one of which is like casualties. And I have been frustrated throughout this war by my inability to gain any confidence as to what the level of casualties is on the two sides. I mean, I heard a seemingly well-informed person the other day say, you know, somebody who thinks Ukraine should hurry up and settle for peace on whatever terms they can get, more or less. But a well-informed, well, I guess, Washington person, you know, ideological, but well-informed, say it was like a, it was like 10 to 1, like Ukraine has lost over 1 million soldiers and Russia closer to 100,000. That seems really hard to believe. But in any event, you also hear people saying, well, Russia's just taken a huge toll right now in terms of men, in terms of troops, and Ukraine, not so much. And it's certainly true that traditionally, you know, offense is harder and higher cost than defense. And I think especially when Ukraine had a drone advantage and when drones became so critical to defense, you could well imagine that the casualties were disproportionate, disproportionately weighted toward Russia. But before I ask you about the internal situation in Russia, which is the other big variable so far as their bargaining strength, do you have any insight into the casualty situation? I mean, you must be better plugged in than I am to Russian sources that pay attention to this stuff and try to figure it out.
I have the same feeling as you. I've seen the exact opposite reports from different sources. What I tell myself as like, here's what I vaguely understand is hundreds of thousands. And probably more on the Russian side because of that logic, offense is more difficult than defense in that sense. But the key thing that I see is, you know, Russia has a bigger population and more people left Ukraine than from Russia. But the key thing that you see is Ukraine is doing a forced mobilization.
Right.
There are a lot of these videos of, you know, people just, it's kind of surreal to watch. There's just like a van that stops and a bunch of guys come out and grab a person. And there are a lot of videos where they fail to grab a person.
And the guy's mother sometimes is standing, like beating the Russians with a purse or something, not a purse, but.
And sometimes there's like, yeah, like four women.
I mean, I'm sorry, beating the recruiters. I meant the guys who are the Ukrainian. Well, recruiters is probably a too polite a word, but no, it's crazy. I mean, that aside, it's just a fact that Ukraine has long been using a draft. There are lots of people who don't want to be in the front who are at the front. Russia, as I understand it, is still not sending conscripts into war. And so everyone, they may have to pay a growing amounts of money to get them there. I don't know. But these are strictly speaking volunteers. That's a very different political situation. I mean, during Vietnam, the reason there was a big protest in the U.S. is because they were drafting guys who didn't want to be there. And people knew them. And some of them were dying. And if it had been an all-volunteer army, I mean, that war might still be going on. I mean, of course it wouldn't, but there would not have been nearly the resistance.
Right. That's the difference I'm pointing to. Now, it's not as clean. Russia did have a mobilization in autumn of 2022 when, I guess, as a response to the original plan not working out. The original plan was for this to not take long. Then. Mm-hmm. They had to adjust. Okay, we're in a war. It's not exactly a special military operation. It's not like the Georgian scenario where it's a few weeks and we're done. It's a war. It's going to take more resources. So they did the mobilization. And then they changed draft. It used to be, I hope I'm not you know, butchering any details here, but it used to be that just the normal draft conscripts into the Russian army where people get trained takes place in spring and autumn. And I think now is the year round. So they're building up the reserves, and there, I think the numbers in the army is bigger now. But you're right that from my understanding, right now and for a while, most of the people on the front lines are people who volunteer, and there is money. There's a lot of money. I mean, a lot by Russian standards.
I mean, I had thought it was pretty much all of them, that there was almost a kind of a clear line, like conscripts don't have to go to war, but maybe it's blurrier than that.
I think it's more like this now than in other periods of the war. There was a moment during the mobilization.
It's blurrier now? Or there are more conscripts now.
It's more professional based now than early in the war when they were scrambling and they had to just put people on the front lines.
So that's a very different situation. And then, you know, there's the question of how much political pressure Putin is under, which I would think not much, since he doesn't have to put up with actual elections, for example. I mean, you do hear, so you hear a couple of things. I was listening this morning to David Petraeus, you know, former director of the CIA and general in the U.S. Army, who was trying to make the case, like most American foreign policy elites, I would say, that, hey, Ukraine's not desperate to cut a deal. Let's keep going. And, you know, he was saying Russia's running out of money. You know, they may run out of money, and that just seems they're not going to meaningfully run out of money. A government can always raise money. It may cause inflation. It may do this. It may incur popular resentment about tax increases, but they're not going to run out of money. And
there's an old Soviet joke about, you know, there have been these falls in the economy, prices go up, prices that are stable in the Soviet Union, like the prices established for good, and then it changes when the government decides to. And there are these clear lines when vodka got more expensive. and the old joke is, a father in the family says, vodka just got more expensive, and the kid says, does that mean you're going to drink less? And the father says, that means you're going to eat less. I think that's kind of like the Russian government, the Russian state has a priority, and it's war. If people need to switch to cheaper food and worse food, and you know, the quality of living goes down, I think there is a long way to go. Russia in the 90s, in the 80s, lived through real poverty.
Right, which you remember.
Throughout the entire country. Between now and where like the bottom is there's a long way.
Yep. I mean, look, if Ukraine is still, you know, hobbling along,
right?
I mean, their infrastructure is subject to much more destruction, and it's just, yeah, I mean, Russia can go on a long time, and you know, you just kind of have to think of it this way. I mean, one frustrating thing is the way people even talk about this. There was this New York Times headline I mentioned to you. This may seem like a little thing, but it was, what could make Russia want peace? And, you know, that's the way it's kind of framed here. Ukraine wants peace, Russia doesn't. Well, you know, there are circumstances. There's a deal Russia would like. There's a deal Ukraine would like. They may be very far apart, but if you were just watching this from another planet, and you would just say, oh, I see. Well, they have different terms under which they would favor peace. I mean, that's the objective situation. And that's why you just have to be realistic about this shit. Unless you think, and look, let me say, it's funny, you know, early on in this war, as you probably recall, I had a position that was, you know, considered modestly transgressive, I guess, in the sense that I was spending a lot of time blaming the U.S. for getting things to a point where Russia invaded, and I continue to blame the U.S. for an absolutely disastrous, stupid foreign policy beginning with the expansion of NATO and a continued inability to understand how things were looking from Russia's point of view and what might make Putin go this far. But because I pay a lot, you know, I put a lot of emphasis on respect for international law, and he is the one who violated international law, I do want him to get the worst deal possible. So like right now, I just feel a little differently about this from some of the people who felt like allies back when I was emphasizing how much I thought we had screwed up to get to this, to get us to this point. Because, you know, it's like, I don't know. I would like Ukraine to get the very best deal possible, for Putin to feel as frustrated by whatever deal he gets as possible. Although you do have to consider long-term stability. You want a deal that can last. So, you know, I just want to say, like, that's my position. But that said, it just really is frustrating to hear all these people who say, you know, that if you put pressure on Zelensky, you're selling out Ukraine. All I want to hear is, like, what is their plan? Like, right now, it looks like if you continue this, more Ukrainians will die, more Ukrainian territory will be in Russian hands, and eventually something very horrible may happen, including the collapse of the nation. And it's just the reason I'm asking these things, like, is Putin under political pressure in Russia? Are the casualties high? Is because unless I hear something really surprising in those realms, I just think Russia is much better equipped to continue this war than Ukraine. And if you want the war to end, you have to reckon with that fact. That's why, you know, when I see headlines like, you know, that seem to imply that, well, Russia doesn't want peace, Ukraine does, that's just not the objective situation. Neither of them wants peace under the terms under which the other ones want peace. That's right. The objective situation. And you just have to figure this shit out. And I don't know. I could just grab the American foreign policy establishment by the neck and say, will you answer some questions like, you know, like, how do you plan to win a war over Taiwan? Or, you know, why don't these chip restrictions actually increase China's incentive to invade Taiwan? Or, I mean, there are just so many questions that you can just listen to all the CNN and read all the op-eds you want. And there's so many fundamental questions that just almost never get addressed. And my question is, what is your fucking plan? What? I mean, do you know? Do you know what would these people say who say you're selling Ukraine out? You know, and again, I hate to see peace on terms that you know, puff Putin up with satisfaction. I hate that. But I do want to understand, how do things not get just worse if we don't? You know, because, again, I'll stop talking soon, but it was late 2022 when I wrote a piece for the Washington Post saying, and I was not alone because the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was saying the same thing, Mark Milley. You know, Ukraine had just had these big gains on the ground. And, you know, Milley said, you know, this is about as good as it's going to get because they are still matched out in resources. You know, it's like, cut a deal now. I wrote this piece saying, yes. Cut a deal now. Biden should play bad cop, because what you hear is Zelensky is under political pressure. Biden could say bad cop. And I just caught all kinds of shit from progressives. You know, Matt Duss, he's a friend, I like him, but, you know, and his co-author, Rob Farley, who just said these, like, horrible things about, you know, I'm whatever, you know, just name calling. And it's like, you could have gotten a much better deal. And you know, it's funny. I had a conversation with Matt on the podcast recently, and what he said about that was, you know, well, but we now know Putin doesn't want peace because Putin wasn't accepting the deal on the table. And I was, as usual, short on sleep and didn't think fast enough to say what I just said to you. Well, there's always terms under which they'd accept peace. And even back then, when Ukraine was in so much stronger position, you could have gotten a deal with Putin that would have been better than a deal that right now would look great to Ukraine. I'm pretty sure. Because yeah, Putin controlled so much.
That's an argument I see a lot, that just what's available has been changing to the detriment of the Ukrainian side continuously since like
Istanbul. So anyway, that's my spiel, but it's just so frustrating. I mean, the blob is just so I'll stop now. We know how I'd finish it.
So I want to respond to you, but first let me throw a question at you from the Non-Zero Discord. So we do have now a Discord server where people are talking continuously, and I invite them to ask a question that I can bring to you. And this relates to you. You were talking about the op-eds that you
By the way, someday I'm going to gain Discord. I'm going to gain Discord literacy, and someday I may actually say, I may not need an intermediary, but for now, thank you. What is the question?
There's the idea that the reason this war has been dragging on for such a long time is the West has not given all that Ukraine was asking in terms of weapons early on, like if the because people were concerned about Putin's red lines. And the question is whether you have adjusted, revisited your stance from the beginning of the war where you were concerned about these red lines. What do you think about that position that if there was more of a unified, you know, pedal to the, whatever the expression is, you know, all weapons that are available given to Ukraine early on, there would be a more powerful push against Putin, and then the war could have ended earlier on better terms.
Oh, that we should have given them more weapons early to make them stronger?
Yeah.
I will say I was like some other people, actually, including some people who were more hawkish than me in terms of supporting Ukraine. There were concerns about what certain things would lead to, like a no-fly zone. You know, you start putting Western aircraft in Ukrainian skies. I still think that would be a bad idea because, you know, you get that shot down. I think we've learned that, so far, strikes on Russian territory have not led to some, you know, sudden expansion of the war or anything. I guess I'd be a little less cautious about that. And I'd also say, I mean, one of my frustrations with Trump is, this is kind of related, I was not somebody who was saying, don't be giving them these weapons. I was never saying that. Mm-hmm. Because Russia had invaded, they had violated international law. It drove me crazy that it took an incredibly stupid American foreign policy to slowly over decades make all of this more likely. But I was never saying that. I don't think I ever said we had sent them something we should not have sent them. I don't think so. Right. I was concerned, but I will say, and I will say further that, as I've said before, my frustration with Trump has been that he hasn't used the threat of arming Ukraine more than he has, you know. The ideal game theory situation, and the funny thing is Trump laid it out, as I've said before, mm-hmm. before he took office. He said, if this was me, what I'd say is I'd say to Ukraine, if you don't take this deal, I'm going to take all your weapons away. I'd say to Moscow, if you don't take this deal, I'm going to load Ukraine up with weapons. Well, that's not exactly what I would have done, but he hasn't done really any of that. The smart thing to do would have been right away, day one, get a big authorization from Congress, which he could have, for a big military expenditure, and give himself the discretion in this legislation to dole it out to Ukraine as much as he wants, and just say to Putin, okay, I'm giving them this week. Like, now I don't know if what you could have gotten out of that, but it would have been a much better bargaining strategy than every week, you know, Trump just being in a different mood, you know, which is what you get with Trump. And some people think that's a great strategic asset. Oh, they fear him because he might go crazy. That doesn't help in a situation like this. if you're really, you know, if you're going to steer two parties toward a deal, like, no, there has to be a real constancy of purpose and strategy. And so I actually, unlike almost everybody who I considered a kind of ideological ally at the beginning of the war, I actually wish Trump had done more of that. Mm-hmm. Because again, I want Putin to get the worst deal possible, but I do think we need a deal. And, you know, we'll see if Trump can pull this off. And of course, the problem is, I mean, you know, Tom Friedman wrote a piece today that, judging by the headline, I thought I was going to hate. But, you know, I actually agree with most of it, including the fact that, like, this is not a real estate deal. I mean, it's so much more complicated than that, you know. And by the way, it's so much more complicated than Gaza. Okay, there are two parties this time. Okay, Gaza, they were calling it a war, but at that point, only one country was actually engaged in it, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it was just Israel bombing. Mm-hmm. And we have huge leverage over Israel, huge leverage, way more than we have over either of these parties. And the only question has ever been, to what extent was a president willing to suffer the domestic political consequences of playing hardball with Israel? Every American president been afraid to. Trump is pretty afraid to, but he was slightly less afraid to. So he at least got some kind of deal. Now, by the way, I would say, during this supposed 2-month ceasefire, Israel is killing, 35, 40 people per week. Hamas is killing 0 Israelis per week. So, you know, that's Israel's idea of a ceasefire and apparently Trump's idea of one. But this is so much more complicated. So the idea, and apparently the way this latest initiative started, is like Trump said, well, we did Gaza. This Witkoff's a fucking genius. Send him, you know. And part of the point of Tom's piece is this is very complicated. And you need to think about, for example, long-term security. You need to understand what it's going to take Ukraine to feel secure enough to at least sell this deal. And again, I didn't even know what that involves. Is Zelensky worried about grassroots pressure more than elite pressure or what? And I don't know, this corruption scandal is like one person away from him right now. You know, when your chief of staff seems to be involved, that's one of the warning signs. And I don't know what the implications of that are, you know, you do have to, and this is a case where, again, I think as much as we fail to put ourselves in Putin's shoes and try to understand, like, what his main issues are, I think there's, on my side of the ideological spectrum, sometimes a failure to understand that, like, if you're Ukraine and, like, you know, guarantees on paper about Russia not invading, right. they're not right. going to feel too great. It's like with Trump among, you know, above all as the president, what does something on paper signed by Trump mean? It doesn't mean shit. No, it doesn't. It doesn't. It doesn't mean shit. So why should they feel secure with anything less than at least a token force of Western Europe or some UN, some kind of troops on the ground? And I suspect that's a real sticking point with Russia because, again, they don't have to end this war soon. But at the same time, I understand, like, if you're Ukrainian at this point, you know, trust is not the first word that comes to mind when you think of Putin.
No.
Or Trump.
Putin, or I suspect increasingly as the time goes by, anybody else. Like, you need structural decisions. That incentivize sides to a long-term peace that are not promises. There's a decision. So you're asked, what's their plan? Referring to what exactly? The blob, the people who say, we're selling out Ukraine if we don't.
Well, if they're saying that Zelensky should continue to say no, and that if Putin doesn't agree to the terms he can accept, he should say no, as opposed to settling for something, you know, worse. It's a challenging situation, I admit, because as I said, it's not easy to imagine Ukraine settling for less than some sort of fairly firm sense of security. But I would like to hear, like, okay, if they're saying Zelensky should say no unless Putin goes, you know, gives us XYZ, what is their plan for Ukraine not getting slowly crushed over the next 2 years?
So the way I look at this lately is, and I don't have answers here, I only have questions, but the questions that I'm asking are, who are the decision makers we're talking about and how much their views of the situation and their interest align with one another and with these broader structures we're talking about? That is, you're saying, like when we say we need to support Ukraine, what that means. Well, who's Ukraine? Because there's Zelensky, who's like a particular person right now in the president's seat whose political future is uncertain because, you know, there's not an election because there's war going on. But as soon as the war is over, there would have to be an election. And he's being, as you say, there's a corruption scandal and his right-hand man was fired or forced to resign. And then said, I'm going to the front lines. I don't know if he's going to actually, but that's the last.
Yeah, I didn't. What did he? This is Yermak, right? Like,
Yermak, yeah.
He's a guy, a longtime ally, I guess, of Zelensky's. They were both in the media business. And
yeah, and he has long been considered the second most powerful person in the country. A lot goes through him. Almost like it would. At least portrayed in the papers as almost like a duo at the head of the state. Like these two people are. This is the unity that is running.
Yeah, and look, Ukraine is a famously, you know, corrupt place, like a lot of post-Soviet states. I mean, communism wasn't a healthy influence in that regard. I think on the corruption front, but I don't doubt that it could reach to Zelensky. But anyway, so what is Yermak? So there's these two interesting players, and you brought to my attention something written by Zelensky, the former head of the military, who Zelensky made ambassador to Britain, some think because he's a political rival. Zelensky wanted to get him out of the country, I don't know, but he's a player too. So there's Yermak and there's him, and we should talk about them. Now, at some point, we should go into overtime. What are we at? 37 minutes. You're the
37.
Yeah, you're the expert on marketing strategy. So
on Russia and on marketing, sure.
Those are the two reasons that I associate with you. Yes.
So let me try finishing what I started saying. So this is the broader question, like who are the key players and what are their interests? And what I'm saying is, for Zelensky, it makes sense to continue the war, because if the war ends on terms, especially on terms that are unfavorable, then the political process starts in a very precarious situation where he has, so Zaluzhny, yes, he's a former commander-in-chief of the Ukrainian forces, and his approval ratings consistently have been on par or higher than Zelensky. And when he was when Zelensky decided to change the commander-in-chief, he sends Zaluzhny out of the country to the UK. That's widely seen as like, I don't want this only real rival in terms of popular support here in the country. So Zaluzhny just published, since these talks started, just published a very long article. You're not the only one. I sent it to you. You said it's almost impossible to read.
I had to bring in an AI to tell me what the fuck he was saying. And
I decided to listen to some Ukrainians discussing this earlier today. And it started with the same kind of like, I'm going to be honest with you. At first, I read the third of it and fell asleep. And like the first few times I commented on it, I haven't even read the whole thing. It's really hard to read, but I finally managed to get to the end of it. It's meandering and long and boring, but it is, when you finish it, it's like a kind of a manifesto. It's him blaming the Ukrainian political leaders were failing at every stage, of which he lists like five different stages in the war, starting with as early as 2015. So at that point, you have to put much more money into the military. But he like breaks it down by stages. At every stage, it's the political leadership of the country, he claims, that failed the country. And so he's like challenging Zelensky openly now and lays out his view, which is victory for Ukraine is the breakup of the Russian Empire, he calls it. Victory for Russia is the destruction of Ukraine as a sovereign state by the means of civil war, most probably. And everything in between is like a cessation of war, but not an end to it. You can even hope for and plan and work for long-ish peace, years of no fighting, but that is still a pause in a longer war that you can use to like regroup. So like point is for Zelensky right now, my sense of the situation is like there's not a clear path to a much more favorable situation, but agreeing to the terms that are being imposed on him is very risky. And war is unpredictable. So let's, like, we don't have to give up now. Let's carry on and maybe things will change. You know, there's always a possibility of a black swan. And maybe over time, Europe is going to put more money and not just money. I mean, there's talks of like Europe needs its own military and so forth. But my point, my broader point is like, there's Zelensky. There are other players in the Ukrainian, on the Ukrainian side. On the Russian side, it seems very consolidated. I don't see any rival to Putin, anything to worry on the front, on the home front. There's Ukraine, which might see or rather Europe, and even that is like a very generalized statement. There are different countries in Europe, and for them to get on the same page takes effort, and whether everybody will get on the same page is a question. But they view the situation differently. There are countries that see Ukraine as fighting their war, like if Putin wins here, is going to go further. And there are countries who are would rather stay away from all of this. And there is like Orban, who's, you know, kind of a pro-Putin guy, you could say. And then there's the US. So all of these are different actors. So there's not like, what's the plan of the West, of the Ukraine and the West? There are a lot of different agents here. And one way of seeing what we're seeing now is that process. This is what I heard recently on a like a Russian podcast, that this latest round of talks is really a process of the US, EU, Ukraine side to actually form a common position. Like here's what we propose. Because Putin is clear on his terms, and his EU basically stopped, like abandoned the diplomatic route a long time ago, and probably too late to come back to the negotiating table from their side. Putin and Zelensky, that hasn't worked. So the negotiating partners are the US and Russia, broadly speaking. So the US, now it's on that agent to figure out what is the position of, like, the shared position of Ukraine, EU, and the US. What are they bringing to Putin to negotiate with?
Okay, you put a lot on the table. I do think we should go into overtime now.
Let's go into overtime.
Now that people are on the edge of their seats. And you can get access to overtime by becoming a paid subscriber to Non-Zero Newsletter. Easy to do.
There's a link to where the overtime segment in the newsletter is in the video description if you're watching on YouTube, in the show notes, I'm pretty sure as well. So click there and from there, subscribe and watch the segment.
And you'll get the satisfaction, by the way, in addition to the satisfaction of hearing more insights from Nikita today, of knowing that you're supporting the little guy, you know? Like, on the one hand, there's like Barry Weiss, you know, people giving hundreds of millions of dollars to, like, say, I don't want to call them stupid things. Things I wouldn't say, let's put it that way. And then on the other hand, you know, you got me begging for what? It's like, what is it, a cup of, let's put this in Starbucks terms. It's like a cup of Starbucks coffee, like, I don't know, per month. What is it? Per year? Per decade?
I don't know how much
it's nothing.
Goes.
It's like I think it is. It's like a cup of Starbucks coffee per century, as I do the math. In any event, if you become a paid subscriber to Non-Zero Newsletter, you can you know, then set up your podcast feed. Always hear the overtimes, plus any other. Bonus content, as we call it in the marketing business. We don't call it, you know, we don't talk about paywalls. We call it bonus content.
What are we going to talk about in the overtime? So
well, we're going to continue this conversation. Like, what is this guy up to? This illusion-y. Is he like, you know, is he maneuvering to be running Ukraine within like a few months or something? Or what? He's a rival? He's Zelensky rival? What's the subtext?
And how will that look like?
Yeah, a lot of things. And yeah, I do want to talk about Ukraine some more. There's other stuff though. What do you want to talk about? I mean, I'm gonna talk about AI.
There is AI stuff, and there is an AI connection here as well. Like you mentioned, the Tom Friedman article.
Yeah. No, I do want to talk about Russia. Oh, you said that Putin is increasingly erecting a kind of electronic fence. It's gotten to the point where it makes it hard for you to, or may make it hard soon for you to. Communicate with your mother in Russia. You're not in Russia. You're in Spain. What's he up to? Plenty to talk about. But first, we have to go into overtime. So thanks, everybody, who stayed with us this far. We encourage you to stay with us farther.